Sorry.
Good morning. I'd like to call the July 24, 2017 meeting of Chelan Public Utility District to order. It's a few minutes after 10 o'clock. Good to see a full house today. Like, before we start, I'd like to remind everyone that today's meeting is being recorded. And if you wish to speak to any item on the agenda, that you come to the table and pick up the mic and state your name and address for the record, so we have that in perpetuity. Also like to remind people that we do welcome any input on any item that we have and try to offer that opportunity, and we'll make those accommodations. Secondly, I'd like to remind you, if you need reminding at this point, to silence your cell phone. And that really helps the conduct of the meetings. First item on our agenda, as is always, is our Pledge of Allegiance and our Safety Minute, today brought to us by Lance Knutson.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Morning.
Morning.
Lance Knutson, I'm the fleet supervisor, and I'm going to do the safety minute on home pool safety. And this is kind of, it's close to home with me, because I had a dear friend who lost a son to a pool incident because there wasn't adequate safety features installed with the equipment. Millions of us enjoy warm weather every year by swimming in our backyard pools and relaxing in hot tubs. Tragically, though, over 200 young children drown in backyard swimming pools each and every year. American Red Cross suggests owners make pools safe by making that a priority by following guidelines. Secure your pool with appropriate barriers and completely surround your pool with a fence 4 feet high or a barrier with a self-closing, self-latching gate. Place a safety cover on the pool or hot tub when not in use, and remove any ladders or steps used for access. Consider installing a pool alarm that goes off if anyone enters the pool. Keep children under active supervision at all times. Stay in arm's reach of young kids, designate a responsible person to watch the water when people are in the pool, and never allow anyone to swim alone. Have a young or inexperienced swimmer wear a U.S. Coast Guard approved life jacket, and ensure everyone in the home knows how to swim well by enrolling them in age-appropriate water orientation and learning to swim courses from the Red Cross. Keep your pool or hot tub water clean and clear, maintain proper chemical levels, circulation and filtration, and regularly test and adjust the chemical levels to minimize the risk of earaches, rashes, or more serious diseases. Establish and enforce rules and safe behaviors such as no diving, stay away from the drain covers, swim with a buddy, and walk, please. Ensure everyone in the home knows how to respond to aquatic emergencies by having appropriate safety equipment and taking water safety first aid and CPR courses from the Red Cross. Any questions?
Very timely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Item two on our agenda is the approval of the agenda. And today, before I ask my fellow commissioners for their input, I'd like to suggest that we remove items 12 and items 15 from the agenda, as those are, my understanding, one is a little bit dated and the other one was handled last meeting. And also would like to share with all who may be listening that there is likely to be action taken coming out of executive session this afternoon. Any other suggestions from the commissioners on items, potential items to be moved to the consent agenda?
I suggest moving resolutions 10 and 11 to the consent agenda, if everyone agrees.
Is there any disagreement with that? In that case, items 10 and 11 will be moved to the consent agenda. And also, I don't see any, I do see a couple visitors in the audience. So this is the moment in time if anybody wishes to have anything added to the agenda and wants to request that of the commissioners. This is the appropriate time to do that, and they'll consider whether or not to place it on the agenda. Seeing nobody rush to the microphone, I think our agenda as it's been modified is approved for the day. All right. Item 3, Old Station Substation.
I want to invite Chad Rispin and Dan Frazier to talk a little bit about the you may recall that we had a conversation a couple months ago about work to add a new substation out in the Old Station area, and we want to provide an update. And we're getting fairly close to bringing you a resolution and an agreement on this.
Okay. Just to follow up with that a little bit, hopefully next couple of board sessions we'll bring forward a resolution to enter into an agreement with Stemelt for future substations. So backing up just a little bit here, provide some context. Our existing the existing electrical demand in the greater Old Station area is served out of an existing substation called Old Station Substation. It was built in 1979. It's been on our plans for several years. We are wanting to replace some equipment. It's 1979 equipment. The reliability requirements for that industrial area is pretty obvious. We want to make sure that it's a key area. We would like to expand also the substation, and I'll show you some pictures and things later, but as I step through the presentation, this is a lot about us having an existing plan in place to rebuild or resupply the existing substation for future reliability or future expansion, but the site won't allow it. It's too small. So as we have these plans in place, Stemilt came to PUD requesting power services for their new expansion, and we asked them, we've had these plans in place, we would like to relocate, rebuild, and have more space for our substation. Is there any chance there would be enough space on Stemilt's property for us to site a substation? And we didn't get no, so we kept talking. So here we are. So stepping into the presentation here, overview of Old Station Substation capacity, kind of where we're at in the existing Old Station substation, the area that's being served by it. The district's plans, as I described earlier in the lead into this, district's plans kind of met an opportunity presented by Stemilt, and appreciate Stemilt being willing to work with us towards a common solution here. And then as this idea of capacity in lieu of a fee. So Stemilt was requesting additional capacity to serve their new facilities, and we're looking for, the PUD is looking for a site for building a substation. So we're looking for a capacity reservation agreement with Stemilt to utilize a portion of the substation in exchange for properties. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. I wanted to make a note here that the energy is not included in this. So rates, kilowatt hour rates, energies, all of those apply and are our standards. So what specifically this is utilize up to 5 megawatts of capacity for that specific substation, that new substation facility, to be able to use to serve their facilities. Just the capacity, not the energy. And then some next steps and some question and answers. So kind of overarching to this, saw this as a great opportunity, meets some existing plans. This provides for a needed substation capacity in the county's industrial area. So as I mentioned, this existing Old Station substation serves pretty key accounts, key customers in that entire Old Station area. We would like to expand, increase our performance of that substation by maybe even having some redundancy and things in there. We cannot do that in its existing site. I'll show you a little picture here in a second. This also sites a substation at the load center. So in some of the work that we've been doing with siting some of the other substations, we've recognized that by placing a substation away from where the substation capacity is needed. There's additional infrastructure and things required in order to bring that capacity back into the area that is needed. So this site's the substation where the load is, where the demand is. It also is a larger site, just about an acre, so it provides a district with space for not only the mobile substation, but also gives us the district the capability to double bank, put two power transformers in there, or two stations on one site, if so we desired. reduce siting and permitting for efforts by the district, so this is an advantage that it's serving the existing customers. It's actually located on the property of one of the customers that we'll be serving, so it's a nice opportunity there, arrangement there. Replaces planned existing equipment at Old Station, as I mentioned before, is 1979 equipment. Industrial demand is a little bit different than residential demand. It's operating at a pretty high level during the day, during the business hours, whereas residential kind of goes up in the morning and then drops back off. So there's a lot higher usage of the equipment out there, so its life expectancy is a little bit less. So even though 1979 by residential standards doesn't seem all that old, for industrial standards, we want to make sure that that we're taking into account the added stress that daily loads are on the station. So here's a photograph of the existing station, Old Station substation. I've put some arrows on there pointing out you can tell that there's some dissimilar colors. It's just an idea of some of the things that we've replaced over the years. This station has become a very high maintenance station, giving us all indications that it's approaching approaching end of life. So you can see the gray colors in there are sort of the newer equipment that we replaced. We've put the middle arrow there is oil filtering. So the cellulose paper inside the transformer is starting to break down over time, and it's creating some issues inside there. So we're filtering some of that stuff out. It's just these are all things that it's telling us it's time. And then the mobile substation, so it's really difficult to get our mobile substation in there and then work, also be performing some work. It would be impossible for us to put another transformer in there and then also be able to get the mobile substation in there. So space is a bit cramped. So those of you that are familiar with Stamilt's expansion, it's currently going on there in Old Station, sort of by the new roundabout there. This is a shot not too long ago, a picture showing their expanded facilities. And the big arrow there is sort of the north part of their property is where we're in conversations about where a potential substation could be located. So we're converging on an acre in the very north end of the site. We have started referring to this new substation or this replacing of the Old Station substation. Started referring to as OMI from OMI Garden. So
I'll take you through some of the deal points and some of the thought process that went through with us and Stamilt. We had a really good group of Stamilt folks and district folks that sat down and kind of talked through the business points and how we can make this work. As Chad said, it was a good planning makes good opportunity, so let's see if we can take advantage of it. So really what Stamilt was going to provide to the district is a 1-acre parcel. So our preference is to have an acre for substations. It gives us the ability to bring mobile subs in. It gives us the ability to have additional capacity if we wanted to add double bank. And they actually had an acre available that wasn't part of their master plan of the site, so that worked really well for us. They were able to carve off the northernmost piece of their parcel so that it didn't impact their operations and their circulation. As we worked through things like all the easements that we'd have to have to bring transmission in, to bring the distribution out, to get our mobile substation in, to get our crews in, there ended up being seven different access easements we worked through. And we were able to do that pretty rapidly when they understood what the needs were and we understood how their site was going to function. It really lined up. The access points they're going to use worked well for us. Our mobile substation, probably all seen that, it's a big piece of equipment to get in, so we had to
design a way to get that in, and they're actually bringing big trucks in along the same route. So it was really kind of, I wouldn't say it was easy, but it was more easy than some projects to get that access figured out. So we were able to get the access easements established as far as getting in and out of the site, and then the getaways. We wanted the ability to get two full substations worth of distribution out of that site, so we had to have a pretty wide channel to get two complete banks out. So they provided us with a way to get out of the site, and then they are right on the Burlington Northern Railroad property, and then we have an easement for our transmission line adjacent to that. So transmission, perfect spot. I mean, it's all those perfect storm things we talk about in siting substations. We had transmission, we had distribution, and we had access. So we were able to put those together. The access and utility easements are all part of this overall document. And so what the district was going to provide to Stamil for that is this capacity at the substation site. Initially, we talked about 4 average megawatts, but as you see their building, they're already thinking about what's our next phase. So it was really smart to go up to 5 average megawatts. And then when we started looking at the values, we were able to look at where our what the district was receiving in this deal and what the district was providing in the deal. And there was a slight disproportion in that. And so Stamil has agreed to do improvements to the site to bring that more in line so that we're meeting really the overall value the district is providing and the value that Stamil is providing, and they're roughly equal value, which is really nice because we were able to do these things and get out of their way. So one of the things that they're going to do is put in a section of the conduit bank under the access so that we don't have to run out there and try to get that installed and be in their way during construction. So they can time that with their construction, get that done, and when we come in to do the substation, we'll just hook onto each end of that bank. Be able to provide our bank, our getaway access. So really good process of coordinating the work and coordinating the values with Stamil. There have been a lot of discussions about how to frame this capacity reservation. It's not something we've done a lot of. There's been a couple other instances like the Longview Fiber substation that we've had some type of capacity reserve. But we wanted to take the lessons learned from those projects and apply them here. And so legal has been great in helping us work through what this reservation agreement should look like. And they've been drafting that for the last couple weeks. And I think we're getting all the deal points put together into a pretty comprehensive capacity reserve in exchange for these other property and property rights. So that's going well. So as I talked about all those different things, the site plan is...
Dan, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. So part of the exchange is we're providing them a guaranteed capacity, amount of capacity. But what I think what you pointed out earlier, they're paying for the energy. Mm-hmm. Even if the energy that is increased by the amount of capacity. I didn't say that very well. They're paying for the energy. All we're providing is a guarantee of capacity.
Correct.
Correct.
Okay.
I like to think of the capacity as being the pipe and the water as being the energy.
Okay.
So
they're paying for the water.
They're paying a portion of the pipe in lieu of a fee, right? They're trading real property and access rights and things for a portion of the use of that pipe, and then the water itself is governed by our existing rates.
Yeah, that's good.
And it's limited to the substation itself. So their contributions are related to the substation, so the capacity agreement will be related just to the substation.
Gotcha.
That's correct.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
How big is that pipe?
How many? 28 megawatts.
Okay. So this site plan it's really just a clip out of the northern part of the Stamil property. Just on the very left side is where Highway 97A is, and these are an amalgamation of different easements we'll need to get into the site. On the right side is the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad. Actually, BNSF owns all the way up about 4 miles up that, or 3 miles up that grade. So this is not part of the short line. This is part of Burlington Northern. So.
Hmm.
A lot of people don't know that, but it's so we're working with BNSF on the access. So we would come down our mobile substation would be able to come across DeMille's property to the north where their fruit store is, the fresh fruit store, and come down along the Burlington Northern Access into the site. And we've sized it basically so they could get in from the east side. But our daily traffic would come in and out. Anything we do for maintenance would come off the highway right down into the site and be able to work on this from that location. The blue down there toward the bottom is what we talked about, the getaways. These are the circuits going out of the site. And the transmission actually isn't shown here. It comes just out of the east side of the site and goes right over to the Burlington Northern. This was developed and we were still working on where that transmission easement would be. And there's a little purple line there at the edge, and one of the requirements is we have a grounding mat for our substations, and so we needed to go a little bit beyond the 1 acre just because of where the ground lie. So we got a 10-foot easement just outside that 1 acre to provide a location for that grounding mat. So that's most of the.
So maybe just in review, so what's in yellow are going to be easements and access rights that the mill will be providing the PUD. The substation itself here, the dark black line, is real property that the PUD will own. Dan mentioned this purple is another easement in here because we're going to have a ground mat that is going to extend off the property. After we started getting into the design, we realized that our ground mat was going to have to extend out a little bit. And then the conduit installation and the rights for that conduit, and then also overhead, the overhead transmission over on this side towards the river. So they're also performing rough grading, so levelizing the site for us so that once their expansion plans are done, that'll minimize the amount of excavation work and things that the PUD will have to do at the time.
Any questions about the site? So finally, our next steps are to finalize this agreement. It's about ready to go for review for Stamelt's legal counsel. We're just finishing up all the pieces on our end. Tentatively, we'd like to be back to the board on August 7th with that resolution for the acquisition of property. The conditional use application with the city would happen this fall. We've already approached the railroad about getting the permit to cross the railroad for the transmission. So we do that routinely, so it's nothing out of the ordinary for our real estate group to be securing those rights. And then Chad's team will start design and equipment specifications, and construction will be planned in 18 and 19.
Now, this will not eliminate the old station substation.
It will. That's the plan.
Oh, it will eliminate it. Okay, so, and this has greater capacity than the current old station?
It has the capability to put two transformers in there where the existing one only has the capability and does only have one.
Okay.
So we have a 1979 model that could be replaced by two new ones over time?
Correct.
Okay.
In a new location?
Yeah.
Right. And that old location just would never be, by today's standards, appropriate for a new substation.
It could be. We'll have to review that. The challenge that we had in our existing plan, which is why we weren't moving forward much, was in order to replace the equipment on the existing site, you got to take it out of service. But we can't take it out of service, so we knew we'd have to do something temporary. So this is where our plans of trying to figure out to do something met with an opportunity. So we'll be building this OMI substation. It'll have greater capacity and expansion capabilities, better access, improved, and then we'll be able to remove, after that's energized and serving the area, we'll be able to remove then from service the old station.
Yeah, so what happens to, have we done that before with old substations? What happens to old substations?
Most
they just
of it gets
get pulled apart and get recycled,
mm-hmm.
Metal recycling. And yeah. It must be costly, though, to tear everything out and
We have
dispose of it.
We have agreements with power transformers. We have agreements with some of the recyclers. And oftentimes the cost and the labor of removing it is about the same that you get for the scrap materials that are in there.
Really?
So kind of ends up being a wash.
But the price is real is down right now, really low. But
yeah, these power transformers just seems like it's different. 20 years ago, they were more of a piece of equipment that you would rebuild. So there was a good used market that was out there. Today, they seem a little bit more like a commodity. And so you run them and recycle them. Not much of a used market and a rebuild market out there. So things have changed.
They have.
So once again, the next few board meetings will bring a resolution, and the two mechanisms will be the purchase and sale agreement and then also the capacity reservation agreement. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Item four is a commissioner-driven item, and it's our balanced scorecard and the status of our where we are for the second quarter. And I know I've talked with each of you one-on-one earlier about there's a at the moment a variety of colors on our balanced scorecard, and I think that's
is that getting passed out to people.
Did we all just up there? Okay. And we've always discussed only identifying the items that where we have an exception to the green. And so the first item is Commissioner Congdon's attendance at Mid-Sea Commissioner Manager meeting.
It is, and it is red. Our target is 60%. Well, these Mid-Sea Commissioner meetings are evening meetings. The commissioners and the managers from the three Mid-Seas, Douglas, Grant, and Chelan, meet usually quarterly, maybe a little more often prior to the Waputa meetings. And our target is 60%, and we're sitting at 40%. And I was trying to think back. I think there was one Mid-Sea meeting when most all of us were at other meetings, out of town at meetings, so that brought our number pretty low. But I suspect we'll pop back up. I suspect we'll bump up to 60% before the end of the year. So we're just keeping an eye on it.
All right. And the next item that is not green is one that I do cover, and that is the top of the second page. And that is annual evaluation of general counsel, which we did conduct in January of this or earlier this year. And so whether or not that should be white or should be green, I think is a question of debate. But we have conducted evaluation on a regular basis, and the next one is not due until January, so not to be really concerned about. The next item that is white is Commissioner Bowles, the annual district budget review and adoption. We're just not there yet.
No, and we are wholly dependent on Kelly for that process, so we'll work cooperatively with you.
We will be there.
We will be. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. And then the next two items that are currently red, Commissioner McKenna, that's responsible board representation.
So
one of them got changed green.
Yeah, I was just sitting here looking.
Yeah, the sheet I have shows it the first one red, so you've updated it already. So you've only got one red.
So the issue has to do with Energy Northwest because of certain circumstances that wasn't met, and I expect that will be attended, that will be improved this upcoming
year. Yeah, and I can speak to that. Instead of being at the retirement luncheon, which I wholly regret missing, I will be at the new board member orientation and then filling that role past that point. So our participation will be restructured.
Yeah. Okay. And then the on page three, we've got a few white ones. First one is Commissioner McKenna's annual review of board performance.
So I think that in my mind, as we complete this process, that would be a completion of our board, our annual board review, and I'm not sure that's an accurate way to look at that. I'd like opinions on that.
Yeah, well, I know we talked about it at the last time we reviewed, and that potentially us completing this in public session, four quarters, that particular bullet would automatically potentially turn green.
Correct.
Yeah, and I would just comment, I think we've, over the years, I don't know how many years we've been doing this with board balance scorecard, at least four, maybe more, probably more. We're fine-tuning it, and we're figuring out how to use it and what really makes sense for us. So I think it's an effective tool for us now.
Okay, and then item E2, Commissioner Bowles, on improving board member skills.
Yeah, and that usually comes out of our September or our workshop, summer workshop, an assessment of where we are, where we need to go, and then a planning process to get that taken care of. And then I guess this second one is the annual review and update a training program for newly elected board members. What I'd like to do is to, as it says here, wait till the end of 2017 and ask our new commissioner, Steve McKenna, how that process has gone and what we could do better and where we have holes.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. All right. Item 5 is business lines financial policies.
Okay. You're going to ask Mark O'Brien to come up to continue the conversation that we've been having over the course of the last couple of board meetings about retail electric service and business line financial policies.
And I'm going to join Mark for a quick introduction on this. So for the record, I'm Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer, and joining me is
Mark O'Brien, Director, Strategic Financial Planning.
And you guys may be kind of getting a little bit tired of seeing us on this topic, but this is about a year-long topic for us to update and extend to the next level of detail our financial policies and guidance. And we've completed district-wide and half the business lines, water, wastewater, and fiber. And then this is our third session on establishing new things for integrated electric. So each of these sessions is a building block, and we've been pretty deliberate and methodical in this, because each building block, we want to make sure we have that strong and stable block to build on for the next thing that we do. And now is the time to do each of these, because we want to build this strong and stable foundation for financial planning and guidance. While we don't have an immediate need, because our financial condition is strong and stable. And it also enables us to get ahead of some of the things we see coming at us, like distributed generation, electric vehicles, more HDL load, those types of things. So that's why you're going to even see us for a while longer through the rest of this year. And this is also, we have the thick red line here, because it's an iterative process too. We're learning along the way with some of these things, and it's possible that we will get down to the end of the exercise and realize something we did earlier in the process doesn't fit quite right, or isn't, now that we learned more, isn't exactly what we intended. And so it is designed naturally to be an iterative process where we would just, if we discover that, we would go back through, refine that and go back through the process. So we do anticipate there would be iterations along the way. So for today, we will review the guidance and the metrics, look at a few examples, and discuss any questions that there may be. And then at the end, we will be seeking board concurrence if we're on the right path and ready to start using these this guidance and metrics in a trial period. Since these are new, we want to try them out first to make sure we get them right. We have a number of metrics here too. We anticipate that we'll learn which ones are the most effective and give the best information for decision making, and that we'll be able to narrow them down one or two maybe as we go. But again, since they're new, we want to try that out first to make sure that we get that just right. The goals of this planning guidance is to enable proactive planning. By being proactive, that allows us to manage for small incremental rate increases over time if needed, which is what we've heard from our customer owners is their preference. But you have to plan early to be able to see a need and back up to when you would need to start doing something about it so you could do it in smaller steps. This guidance also provides us that guidance we need to start more detailed rate design because it's based on some of these metrics. And those things I talked about, distributed generation, electric vehicles, HDL, they require a deeper level of detail on the components of rate design so that we can design those correctly to reflect the unique characteristics of each kind of customer. And then this will also help provide that targeted early warning signs so that we know, again, when we're starting to veer off the path, so we can take action early and avoid the potential for any need for large rate adjustments, which can occur if you realize too late in the process that something's needed and then you have to take larger action. So all of this guidance is really beneficial for all of those goals, but in the end, they really are planning purposes only. It doesn't impact the discretion of the board to set future rates, and there's another public process we would always go through should that be the case. So this will help us with that planning. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark to focus on the benefits for our customers and the details.
Thanks, Kelly. In addition to the internal workings of rate design and those types of things, this is also pretty important for our customers. This will enable us to recognize, to take action in more modest steps over time, again, as they've requested from us, reducing the potential for those large rate adjustments and with short notice. And again, I think it will give even a clearer understanding of our total cost structure to the rates that they're actually paying, so they're more aware of the fact that they are getting a fairly good deal. Even though we are a low-cost entity, even in a total cost environment, having rates that are actually below total cost is even better for those retail rate customers. So with that, the next slide is just an overview of the proposed guidance. So these are more of the philosophies behind what's going to be driving these metrics and the monitoring of those efforts. We'll circle back at the tail end for confirmation of these, but just to quickly review these again, focusing on that small incremental rate increases over time as a key philosophy. Identifying that that inflationary rate increases are really going to what we're talking about here related to representing small incremental adjustments. We do want to avoid over-reliance on the wholesale market. Identifying that we're not going to be using one single metric, but a combination of metrics that will help identify when action is needed and actually help identify what types of action may be most suitable. Again, this will be a key component in initiating some discussions on additional rate design efforts to address new types of loads coming into the district's area. And again, as we continue to review these and test these, we'll continue to further review these as we learn how these metrics are working for us and adjust accordingly. So then I want just to summarize here, we have several metrics that will be providing insight for us. The first grouping here are the new ones that we've been talking about. So we have three metrics that specifically look at the retail electric operations. One looking at a total cost ratio, one looking at an operating cost only ratio, so that would exclude like depreciation. And also just looking at the overall gap related to the retail operations and managing that to a certain level. So those are the three areas, and those are targeted to different levels, initial targets to help us monitor when we think action may be needed when we reach those thresholds. In addition to that, looking a little bit broader at the entire kind of integrated electric entity, monitoring the overall market-based margin that's being produced for the district, and establishing a threshold where at some point in time we would want to trigger some discussion on potentially taking rate action if we're getting too over-reliant on those revenues. And again, those will be net margins from that activity. And beyond that, we've got the existing district metrics. Again, these are a little broader. Generally, the actions are broader. So these may also indicate a need for rate action, but a lot of other actions are contemplated when we're looking at the overall district metrics. Again, one of the reasons we need to get a little more specific on actions or metrics that will drive rate-type actions more so than the broader district metrics, which are pretty wide open as far as what actions you may take. In response to commission request, just to get a sense for the magnitude, the impacts of potential rate adjustments. Again, depending on the level of inflation that we're under, I went through and created a quick table here, the 1% to a 5% range, just to give you an understanding of the magnitude, the impacts of the district related to a annualized rate adjustment action plan. Currently, the base retail revenues are roughly $50 million. So if we looked at that as a base and we looked at over a five-year window, and if we had a five-year rate action plan, and this could be starting at any point in time in the future, just to give you a sense of the magnitude and how quickly the district could cover either increases in cost or a reduction to our revenue streams. So again, noting our revenue base is relatively small compared to our operating cost or even the overall district's revenues, just to give you a sense for the magnitude of those impacts. And these are in millions.
Thank you.
One thing I wanted to do was just give you a sense for what we're talking about as we move forward once we get the guidance established and initiate the review of this. So the overall, and we're going to target just looking at one of these metrics. Again, we'll be monitoring all of these metrics, but just taking one as an example, I want to walk you through kind of the steps to anticipate as we go forward. So again, the first effort will just be monitoring the overall district's forecast in conjunction with those metrics. We'll come to the board quarterly as part of the financial update and give you a status on those. Again, in the event it appears that action may be needed in the near term, we will present action item action plans. Again, a series of those, and I'll go through a couple of examples type of things we would bring to the board. Again, then we would respond to the board's direction and implement any of those action plans or that may be needed. And then continuing to review the overall planning guidance and update as needed. One caveat there, I would note that since we're going to be testing several metrics, once the approaching metrics and targets are established, then we will look to incorporate that guidance into our long-term forecasting efforts. An example there would be as we established liquidity requirements, that helped us identify when we would assume that we would actually need to go out in the market potentially to get debt financing in order to maintain reserve levels. So that's the types of things that we would come back to the board as we fine-tune those metrics and that guidance. Then we have a clear communication understanding of, what actions, type of rate actions, when, and what type would be needed associated with that longer-term forecast. Next slide, just kind of a quick example of how we would monitor these. This is looking at the first graph on the left. It's just looking at our current revenue stream at the bottom in red compared to our current total cost forecast. Again, as just noting here, you can see that things continue to widen. Again, no expected changes to retail revenues outside of growth in the load. But we are looking at, 4 to 5% and average annual increased operating expenses. And that's driven in part by inflation and also just by expansion of services, in the county. The other side of the graph is the associated metric that's being driven off of those, that forecast, revenues and expenses, and just identifying, when that threshold, that 65% level threshold is being met, and that's out in that 2023 timeframe. So that's a quick example of how we're going to monitor these types of metrics going forward. The next step would be to come to the board with action plans. These would be more specific to rate action plans, but not limited to rate actions. Other actions could also be proposed, but this is specifically focusing on what type of rate action plans we might bring to the board. I've got three different views here. This one is more of a reactive approach, deferring as long as possible. And so we could push out action out to that 2023 timeframe. In the event we push it out more closer to the last minute type of approach, It would require a higher related rate adjustment. In this case, we would probably be looking at about a 3% adjustment to be able to maintain that level if we wait more toward the last minute type of approach. The next one would be another action plan, which would be more proactive. And so we would move that up several years, maybe to a 2020 time frame. Again, that would enable us to have a lot lower rate adjustment. Again, we're trying to target plans that would be associated with inflationary type levels. This would require about a 1.5% adjustment, again, to maintain that staying above that targeted level in the event that that is one of the metrics that we decide is more appropriate. The third one is just kind of a balanced approach between the two. Again, that looks at initiating action slightly ahead of where we see there might be a decline below that targeted level. And so that would be establishing some action plan in 2022. And this one is using a 2% annual rate action plan. And again, that's maintaining, at least in this current forecast, maintaining revenues in alignment with that targeted threshold. So those would just be examples of rate action plans that we would bring to the board. Again, I would note again that there would be other action potentials that could occur depending upon the particular metric that we're focused in on. So any questions with kind of, as we go forward, how we're going to be handling this guidance and how we're going to be discussing with the board, primarily be that quarterly update and have that discussion ongoing.
I just like it. I think it's really helpful.
Yeah, I do too. And I think perspective, it was around, 2008 when we had the surcharge at 9% for about a year and a half?
It was about 2.5. Was it 3?
Yeah, maybe close to 3 years. But yeah, started in that, started realizing it at the end of 2008. I think it was 2009 when we actually implemented, and then a couple years in place before.
Yeah, and then it went away. Are we aware of when was the last time we actually had a rate increase?
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, in 2008, or going into 2008, the board approved a 2.5%. Adjustments, along with a lot of other rate refinements, rate design type things that we did.
Right. Yeah.
Rather than implement that 2.5% rate increase, we put the surcharge in. That was in kind of the same timeline that the economy dropped off and markets dropped off. So we deferred that 08 rate increase. That plan, those rate design plans were actually finalized and made fully effective when we pulled the surcharge off. So the surcharge was there for roughly 3 years at 9%, right?
Yeah.
And so we actually had a 6.5% adjustment down when we pulled that surcharge off, and we incorporated the remaining aspects of that rate design. So technically, it was a 2.5% in 2008, would have been the last one if you ignore the surcharge, temporary surcharge that occurred. Prior to that, it was back to 2000.
Okay.
And so I think, in looking back over
2012 was when
we implemented
the 2.5 went in, the surcharge came off. So when we count back of how many years it's been since our last rate increase, we use 2012 as that base year.
Okay, and that percentage was approximately
2.5.
2.5.
So you see it as a 6.5% reduction because we removed a 9% surcharge and implemented a 2.5% increase, but we're just trying to be very transparent with that, that there was
an
overall increase, or we took steps to do an increase there.
That's remarkable.
Other comments from commissioners on the input they're seeking? I saw several nods of, I think, agreement. I'd just like to comment that for my commissioner's knowledge, Kelly and Mark, I know made multiple presentations to you, and I wasn't there, and so they gave me a full-hour tutorial a couple of weeks ago, catching me up and getting me up to speed, and at that moment in time, I saw the value in what they're presenting and said, this is what we should be doing. Looking that far down the road, this is great value. So thank you for what you're doing. Yep.
I have a question.
Sure.
I find this really helpful, and I've really appreciated the district metrics that we've been looking at, and I know this is kind of going backwards here a little bit, but how long have the district metrics been in place? I mean, it seems like a very healthy thing. We keep referring to that and reporting on that, and
right.
I'm just curious how long those metrics have been in
place. So we've actually had used metrics for quite a long time, but the district-wide metrics kind of as they currently stand were in 2010 for our 2010 to 14 strategic plan. That's when these kind of gelled in the form that they're in now, and the array of those that we're using before we maybe focused on a couple fewer ones like just cash and debt, but we expanded that to these operational ones and we refined our methods around those, and then each year since then we've made improvements on them. So there's been small refinements to them along the way, just as we realized something maybe didn't quite work or we could do it better. So we have made refinements to those all along the way.
Thank you.
Is there any member of the public that wishes to provide any input on this proposed approach?
Here. Kelly, I just have a question of curiosity. Back in 2000, which would be the previous rate increase, do you recall how much the rate increase was at that time?
I don't. Darn it.
I went back and looked back to 2000 and looked at the average increase. I think it's less than 0.5%. So we've had relatively, I think we had one year where we had a double digit. I think it was maybe around 13% in that late 90s timeframe. But since 2000, they've been pretty far in between, you know, few in between, relatively flat and actually well below inflationary type impacts.
Absolutely. I can see that. Our inflationary costs far exceed our rate increases.
Yes.
In the last 17 years anyway. And having the opportunity to chat with other commissioners from around the state, including some within our Mid-Sea region, seeing the fact that we have not had rate increases that certainly have come anywhere near the rate of inflation, it's truly astounding and wonderful that we have been able to do that in the past.
We actually have a chart that we could refresh to that tries to compare that to inflation, just to show, you know, over time how the long-term rate increases have compared to inflation. So we could refresh that. I pride myself on trying to anticipate commissioner questions, and you got me.
Sorry for that.
But we can refresh that information and send it out.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
So with that, I just wanted to just quickly identify kind of the next steps. Again, you know, we're going to continue to monitor and report these metrics during this trial period, kind of test them, how effective they are, establish the communication and the monitoring, you know, means as we move forward. This will help us initiate some additional discussions with the board related to additional rate design type concepts, philosophies. We are planning to try and incorporate these metrics and this guidance into the current five-year business planning effort. And we're just now initiating initial drafts of that. And so that will be coming to the board, I believe, first part of October, as far as that five-year look, which is the 2018 through 2022 timeframe. And again, just we're going to continue to reiterate back through this process as needed. And so if we identify that there's a weakness or we're missing something or things need to be adjusted, that's going to be a continual discussion with the board as well as with management as we go forward. Understanding we're just kind of testing these, trying to vet them out so we can apply them when in a long-term type of planning concept. So with that, the next slide is just a kind of overview of where we've been and kind of where we're going. Again, we'll be back to the board throughout the rest of the year, off and on, further progressing some discussions related to the retail rates in particular, so as well as debt funding type concepts that will be driven off some of these metrics. So, any other last questions?
Great, thank you.
Just, thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, excellent work.
Yes.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yes.
Appreciate the direction we were going.
Next up, we want to give you an update on the facilities implementation plan. So we've been working since we presented the strategic plan to you on facilities. This is just another step along the way. It's not a decision meeting, but an opportunity to give you some visibility as to the activities that we have underway. Dan Frazier will present.
Thank you, Steve, and board. Thanks for the opportunity to address today. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services, back here again. So this, as Steve mentioned, is an update. When we came to the board last in March and April, we presented where we were on the strategic plan itself. Had some recommendations on next steps, and in April came and talked about what an implementation plan was and what we'd be looking to do. And the way I term the implementation plan is the how would we even do this? And so that's really where we've been spending most of our time is to kind of flesh out some of the assumptions that were made through the strategic planning process, and look at what it would take to implement something this ambitious. So today's agenda, first we'll do a little bit of a summary of previous work to kind of set the table for how we approach the implementation plan. We'll update you on some key areas of the implementation plan. We're not going to go through the whole thing today. I do have more time than I thought I'd have, but I'll try to keep it brief.
Actually, you don't.
We'll talk about next steps, and there's some steps coming up pretty quickly onto this work. And we'll take any questions. Where this whole thing started was back at the strategic plan level, 2015 strategic plan, and that third one there, the excerpt from the strategic plan, where our priority is to reinvest in our core value-generating assets, and those include facilities. So that's been our charter to do this plan. And we've used the district values and mission and vision in developing all that. And as we started to work on this, we came up with these four or five core goals that we've tried to keep in the forefront. And as we get into implementation, you start balancing goals and thinking what you can and can't do. And so we've tried to keep these in our forefront, the maximizing productivity, optimizing those service levels, providing the best financial value, and this is one that takes quite a bit of time to determine, provide that cost predictability that we are all seeking when we're budgeting, especially 5 and 10 year forecasts. And then, of course, increase that safety of both our employees and the public. So this was the reason I kept this slide in here. Is this something that has resonated throughout the development of this plan? Is what are our standards? I heard that a lot on the tour that we had in viewing district facilities. What standards are we going to try to achieve? And these are some of our compatriots here, Grant County PUD and Pierce County, Mason County PUD, others. We're trying to really develop what's the benefit of developing a standard, and how would we pursue holding ourselves to that standard as we develop. So there's lots of different things that come into standards, whether it's the building systems, location, the durability of what we use for materials. So all these things we keep revisiting, what is a standard that the district should be applying? And a lot of these are industrial standards. What is the industry doing in these areas? So. As far as the implementation plan itself, the major areas of work and the four takeaways I'd like to talk about today are we've been working on the siting evaluation for the potential headquarters campus. We've been working on confirming the scope and the budget of all three sites, and this is obviously very important. The budget's going to have a lot to do with this. So we had to go in and vet out those assumptions that we made, and we've had varying results with those, but we're applying those with good cost estimates to a budget. Something that came up that we just touched on in the implementation plan explanation was this idea of an alternate contract delivery method. This is something that's you see more and more with schools. Steve mentioned that the BPA had approached these types of delivery methods where you have a partnership with the contractor instead of just our typical design bid build process. So I'll go a little bit through what some of the potential benefits of that process would be. And then finally, development of our program resource needs. So this is a humongous undertaking, and we're trying to figure out exactly what resources we need at the district and outside the district to achieve that. So as we talk about our siting options, I'll take you through three options that we looked at in depth, and I'll tell you about a fourth that we did some initial evaluation and have stopped working on. But this is what we call Old Station North, and so this is the ability to, we're testing the ability for us to provide a functioning facility and not use the Horan block. It was an area we talked quite a bit about in February, March, April about the district's use of that facility. We're working with the port to come up with other options. This actually would preserve the ability for the Horan block to be used for something else, but there were several flaws in this particular site, most of which is the displacement of existing businesses. That's not something we want to be doing, is taking a site that a current business is operating out of. They have good employment. We don't want to be dislocating or trying to use that existing property. So although we could probably fit it here, we weren't able to do it just with vacant lots. We had to get onto some other properties in order to fit our site. So that was the Old Station North. Old Station South 1, we'll call this one. This is one where we would use the Horan block and some properties to the north of the Horan block, but all south of Technology Way. This would create the operations facility really down on the Horan block and more administration parking and crew facilities north of Old Station Road. This had some really good advantages in sight lines. When you're working on these type of operational facilities, and really this is mostly about an operations facility, having those sight lines between the buildings is very important. And if you notice the look between the administration and crew building, which is the blue and brown building to the north, down through, it provides really good understanding of what's happening on your site. And that's something that it's very common in these type of facilities to do, is to be able to look down from the administration and crew rooms down through these to see what's going on out in the yard, provide really good visibility. But however, this also displaced some existing businesses, which is not something we're wanting to do. So this is we're called the Old Station South 2, which is a little more compact design. And that is really the one that seems to tick more of the boxes, so to speak, when we're talking about what we're trying to achieve in a facility. It has good internal sight lines. You still have that ability to see through the site. There's very good operational workflow as far as what it takes to get our crews in and out of the site and connection to existing transportation facilities. Excuse me. It does not impact existing businesses, which is something we wanted to make sure we were able to achieve. And honestly, it has a little bit better off-site aesthetics. And what I mean by that is when you're approaching this, coming into Wenatchee, you don't want to create something that is an eyesore or that has such an industrial feel or look to it that it's not welcoming. And this site plan allows us to have things a little bit below grade. There's quite a grade difference between the highway up here along the right side or left side of the page and the site itself. And then you have this more aesthetically pleasing building in the front of the site. So approaching from the west, you have a little bit more of the look of the CTC or the look of some of the existing office buildings out there and not so industrial. And then coming from town out of town, some of those would be depressed below your line of vision. And again, you'd be looking at kind of more aesthetically pleasing facilities. So this one is starting to, you know, percolate to the top as probably the preferred option as we move forward. But we're in the process of evaluating these right now. Question?
The print's so small, I'm trying to read this little triangle to the left, bottom left.
Oh.
What is that
actually, I think it says poles there. I think it is very small. So that is actually a piece of property the district currently owns. We have three small water buildings on that site, some water storage. So what we anticipated doing was probably going up against the embankment and providing some retaining walls and really hiding any kind of pole storage from the public's view. You'd drive right over the top of that and not even know it was there. In fact, most people don't know those buildings are there when they drive by every day. And we have transmission in that area, so we didn't want to have anything that had a building footprint or anything in that area.
Question on this particular plan, and I haven't looked at the others too closely. On the parking side, you've got you know, and here we take up a lot of space with parking.
We do.
Has any evaluation gone into building multiple-story parking facilities?
It has, actually. We have looked at multiple-story parking. At this point, unfortunately, in the Valley, ground is still cheaper. It's about $30,000 per parking space for a parking structure. And that was actually one of the fatal flaws in the fourth option that we looked at. So one of our expansion availability at this site would be to, if we needed to expand, we could deck parking in order to take up some of our existing parking with buildings at a later date. Okay. And we could deck it at that time. Okay. But it is very, very expensive for parking. So the fourth option, which I didn't include in the slide deck, it was a Holly Street option. So the district already owns about 13 acres at Holly Street, including our switchyard and substation. We would be able to use about 10 acres of that for operations and service center. We would need to acquire additional property from neighboring landowners. The difficulties with that site include transportation, availability of parking, because of the way things laid out on that site, we ended up with a 5-deck parking structure just to fit all the vehicles. We have a lot of vehicles that between here and Holly Street would be on the site. So it became very, very cost prohibitive to use that site. So that one came off of the table. We thought there would be a good opportunity since we already owned part of it. But a lot of the other difficulties became the fatal flaws of that site. So additional scope confirmation, we have been sitting down with the groups at both Rocky Reach and Rock Island. Rocky Reach was a great a process where we confirmed what we did in the first round of work and said, what's the best thing? Are we going to get the productivity that we would want to see? There was some what we call microphasing that we talked about. How would we continue to use the C-17 shop during a construction project? And how would we impact our other projects going on, like large unit rehabs and the other work that's anticipated? So we were able to talk through those. What we determined was the scope of the work was correct. It is the right thing to do. What we need to continue to work on is the phasing. What parts do we need now? What can wait until later? And how would those decisions we make impact our other work, the hydro work that we'll be doing out there? So we're going to continue on that phasing discussion on this one, but we definitely confirmed our scope and the budget is really right in line with where we were back in March. Rock Island was a little bit different. Excuse me, I have a little drink here. With Rock Island, during the initial work, we hadn't really fully developed what the impacts of Powerhouse 2 modernization were going to be on our plan. So Powerhouse 2 modernization plan has continued to mature, and we know a little bit more about what the world will look like during Powerhouse 2. And that has impacted what we thought would be the best scope on that project. There'll be a number of contract crews, and they're going to be spending a lot of time right there on that, what we call Lower Chelan, on the right bank in the middle there. And our initial plan was to provide additional facilities down in that area. And what we heard from engineering staff and operations staff was they think it's going to be too congested during that construction with all the other work going on to provide those additional facilities. And what they'd really like to see is a few less facilities down there in their everyday. And we heard from the people that were there during the tour, getting a truck down, turning a truck around is very difficult. Last thing we wanted to do was make it worse for them. So we were able to kind of quantify what those impacts would be, and we've moved some of that development up away from that right bank area there, or where that big gantry crane is right at the end of the deck, and pulled those things a little bit further up the road. And then some of those facilities we moved up on top of the hill where there's adequate place for them. We talked about what this would mean in terms of the savings we were anticipating from all the cross-deck traffic, and they don't see a substantial change. You're not going across the deck. You're not waiting on that. They would provide small tools and consumables down at deck level for the crews to use, but major tools and major supplies would be up above. The other thing that's going to need to occur during Powerhouse 2 modernization is the contractor is actually going to need some facilities to do large work. And what we've done in the past is provided a place for contractors to build what they need to do their work. And then they'll build something that has a very short life, and they'll leave, and they'll either take it down or will inherit a wooden frame building.
So we thought it would be better for us to determine what the contractor is going to need and either specify for them to build what would meet our long-term plan or actually build it and provide it for their use for the interim of the powerhouse rehabilitation and then make it fit our plan for our 50-year plan and be able to use those facilities long-term. So we're in the process of that. We've developed some really good ideas around that. The numbers are still a little high, and we're continuing to refine those numbers down. But we're not far off from the scope we were originally at, but I think we're going to get that longer-term value as we move through this coordination with Powerhouse 2. So it's really timely to get this information about what the world will look like at Rock Island. So again, this is going to be another phasing issue. What needs to go first? What needs to be done before Powerhouse 2 starts? What are the impacts from the B1 through B4 work that's going on? So a lot of work with the operations staff on what's going on down there to make sure that we're not going to negatively impact their work and we get benefit out of the work we're going to be doing. So this is when we get to the discussion about financing and phasing. So the initial plan that was presented back in March had a very ambitious timeline. It had about a 3-year implementation plan on the hydros and a 5-year implementation plan for the headquarters campus. We understand that that's probably not something we can actually achieve just with district resources. It takes a ton of project management and project development. So what we're looking at now is somewhat we call right-sizing that work and phasing it appropriately, making sure we get the best benefit for in a timely manner. So that quote-unquote low-hanging fruit, we want to achieve the savings we've been trying to achieve. The cross-deck traffic is an easy one to say, how do we achieve that savings on cross-deck on Rock Island? The stranding our crews down in the downtown core when most of their work is north of town, how do we achieve those savings? But not make the full level of investment in too rapid of a manner. So that's something that we'll be working with finance on and the architects and trying to figure out what's the best way to phase this project. And so what we'll be doing is coming back in August with some concepts surrounding what the impact on budget would be on different phasing opportunities. However, by the numbers, we are still where we were in March. So this was the Rocky Reach scope of $32.6 million, the Rock Island scope, or I'm sorry, yeah, $32.6 million, the Rock Island scope of $36.2 million, and headquarters Holly Street of $114 million. So we've really confirmed Rocky Reach and headquarters as far as the anticipated scope is what we needed. It really is phasing that we'll move these numbers. And Rock Island, we're continuing to refine that scope along with the Powerhouse 2 work so that we can maximize our investment there. So this is a discussion, it's an interesting one for me. I've been a design bid build guy my whole life. I've done a couple design projects, design build projects. But this is something that's really very popular in the industry right now, and it's creating really good outcomes, is this concept of construction manager, general contractor. So design bid build is the typical what we all do. We design a project. We put it out for bidders. The bidders come in and provide bids, and they bid it. They build it. What it takes is a high level. You get a high level of design control, but you don't get the teamwork and the collaboration that you get from building a team. You have a lot of change orders with this type of work. If you didn't think something through completely, you've got the exposure for change orders and cost overruns. And we're the ones bearing that risk through that process. But the concept of GCCM, General Contractor Construction Manager, you actually select a contractor based on qualifications, the same way we would select an architect or an engineer and their ability to achieve what you're wanting them to achieve. So you get them involved early. You get them involved in what we call constructability reviews and those kind of things and the ability for us to achieve this program. And once we have them on board, they contribute as part of the team. One of the things it takes, though, is a full commitment to execute this as a team and not just a contracting agency telling a contractor what to do. We think there's a lot of benefit here, and we're going to bring in an expert that's going to help us work through the concept of going this direction. And I think it does give us the ability, there's a much higher achievability rate to get what you finally want. There's some early indications that this may have a slight financial benefit, but we're working through those numbers as we go through. And finally, resource management. We're drawing our own org charts here to see what it would look like to execute this. And the green boxes are what the PUD contributes to the project. And so we'd have project managers at each of the sites. We'd have scope core teams. And then we have an overall core team, and that rolls up to the commission as far as all the decision-making, things like go, no-go, and what the overall project would look like. So we're working through this and the financial piece to give us the direction as to what we would recommend for going forward. Our next steps, we'll continue working on the implementation plan, these four pieces being key. We'll complete the headquarters evaluation, talk about phasing and budget, figure out if we are going to go with a GCCM project or which of the phases could be done that way. Then we'll be continuing our outreach and really kind of kicking our outreach into higher gear. We have our internal stakeholders we're working with, and those are the ones that are contributing to all these items in the implementation plan. And then we have external stakeholders. We've started working with a facilities working group that will represent throughout the, with representation everywhere from all the cities and throughout the county. And we're working with our agency partners, especially the port, the city, Wenatchee Downtown Association, Chamber of Commerce, and making sure we're dealing with this potential impact to downtown appropriately. So one of the things that we wanted to query today was similar to the financial work. Are we going in the right direction? Are we hitting the right, are we answering the right questions? Is there additional work that the board would like us to focus on so we can answer all those questions? There's some additional appendices after this, and if you have any questions about those, I'd be happy to answer them. But we'll be coming back with that financing and phasing information in August, and then we'd like to provide any additional information at that time so we can move toward a decision point.
Questions? Comments?
Oh, good.
Dan, I have one question, and that is that since we have various locations that we're considering with respect to the headquarters, and there seems to be some variability with Rock Island still, is there going to be a presentation based on the return on investment for each one of those sites? I would assume that they vary.
They do. So it would be similar to I think it was the March presentation where we have each of the three scopes. When we have those all confirmed, we'd go back and give you the net present value for the level of investment. And you're right, the numbers at the headquarters can vary based on the site development costs. There are some I won't call it challenges, we think we call them, on that.
Opportunities.
Opportunities. on the southernmost North Wenatchee site that could contribute to costs. We're hoping that there's offsetting costs that will keep us inside that budget. But we would do the final analysis and be able to say, yeah, this we're still achieving the present value savings that we anticipated with this cost, or if the cost has changed, how that's affected that, the bottom line.
Okay. Thank you.
Additional questions? Questions from any member of the public? Thank you.
All right, thank you.
I want to invite Kelly up. We have, I guess I'll call it cleanup, on a motion from the spring when the board decided to put aside a reserve, a financial reserve, for facilities. And you actually did pass that motion, but left open the question as to how much. And I think you had wanted to have a full board available to you to be able to have that discussion. So, Kelly's got some materials here. They're basically the same materials you saw in the spring, but it has been a while, so we'll take a moment and just go through those and remind you about the question on the table.
Great. Thank you, Steve. So, yeah, as that quick refresher, back in the March-April timeframe where the preliminary study results of the long-term facilities plan were being discussed, the board also asked staff to look into establishing a designated fund as part of the long-term facilities plan to plan for the need that was identified here. And so as part of that work, the board did pass a motion in April establishing the fund for the purpose of investing in the long-term facilities plan. The logistics around the fund are that it will remain unrestricted for external reporting purposes because it's designated by the board, and the board can undesignate it just as they designated it. And so that's why it's only an internal restriction rather than an external restriction, but it's just good to kind of anticipate what it will look like from the beginning. But establishing the fund really does demonstrate that planning ahead for the identified need of the long-term facilities plan and provides that visibility to the funding activity. But as part of that, establishing the fund, the initial deposit amount, determining what the right amount was for that was deferred until the full board could be present. So diving into that question about what should be the initial deposit amount, staff developed a couple options, which the first option would be to make an initial deposit of $20 million into the fund, which is the amount in 2016 that our bottom line results exceeded budget. So that would show that, you know, there was some additional above what was planned, and to put that as the initial funding into that fund. But the second option is any other amount that the board might see as a better fit for establishing that the initial amount in that fund. But future amounts can be added to the fund as directed by the board. They can be applied to the projects. You know, the fund kind of gets established, but we don't spend out of the fund for every project. We hold the money in there, and then maybe the as the board decides how they'd like to use those funds, then we would apply it. And so the initial amount just establishes an amount in there, but there's plenty of discretion of the board to adapt as we go through time and know more about the overall plan, the overall financing approach, and the eventual spending pace. So, and all of those can be done at the discretion of the board. So with that, just the comment is, and through motion, we can make this initial deposit amount too. So I'd like to pause there to allow time for discussion of board discussion around that. What should that initial amount be?
Commissioners.
I wasn't part of the earlier discussion, but I'm okay with this.
Option A, or you're okay with?
A. You know, and then, but A doesn't eliminate B. So, you know, I think we need to take a look at how we can continue to feed it as needed.
Other comments?
So has anything changed as a recommendation from staff on, I mean, our initial discussion of that $20 million? Seem like a good starting point. And is there anything new that we would need to consider?
I think the rationale still holds about looking to results that we've experienced and identifying those results that exceeded the budget as a really great starting point for the initial deposit. The project, as you just heard the update, there wasn't anything in there from a financial perspective that would lead us to think we would need to change that amount. But as Commissioner Bowles pointed out too, this is a multi-activity type account too. So as we know more and go along, there will be more opportunities to make decisions about funding and utilization of this account. So with all of that in mind, option one, in my opinion, still is a really good way to go about it. But there may be other things the board would like to take into consideration that staff has not.
Commissioner Arsenault.
So, Kelly, as I hear you talk, I kind of get excited about the concept that this might, maybe I'm not putting words in your mouth, but this would become a formalized presentation then at the end of every budget year, And piece of that financial presentation is to come back and revisit surpluses that might be unplanned or planned that would be eligible for contribution to this fund. Is that kind of what I'm hearing
you say? I think that we could do that, but I don't know that you would want to limit yourself to only that. I think there could be other activities that influence the need for decision making around this, even just maybe when you know more about specifics of the plan. So I think that can be an element, but I don't think you would want to limit it to just that or require it to be that. Just kind of look at all the facts at hand at the time. Right. But I think that is something we will want to actively do as we go through time. Just like we're doing on some of the planning that we talked about in the long-term financial plans. I think we need to kind of take all those elements into consideration and see where it leads us for that more detailed decision-making.
Other comments? Is there a desire at this point to make an initial deposit?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion directing staff to deposit an initial amount of $20 million into the board designated fund for the long-term facilities plan. The fund was established per board motion on April 3rd, 2017 for the purpose of investing in the long-term facilities plan.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Steve, you indicated manager items?
We do have some manager items today, so I would like to ask. Okay. Kim's going to come up and provide us an update on a community event that will be occurring at Rocky Reach.
Good morning, Commissioners. Kimberly Craig in Communications. Just wanted to invite you as all PUD employees are invited to Wenatchee Valley Chamber Business After Hours at Rocky Reach on, on Thursday. Yes, and that's from 4 to 7 at the, yes, starts at 5, 5 to 7 on Thursday night at Rocky Reach. And just also wanted to mention that Chelan PUD will be one of the participants on August 1st at the National Night Out at Centennial Park. That is a national organization that encourages people to come out and meet their neighbors, meet their community law enforcement and firefighters, and their friendly public utility will be there as well. We'll be talking about electrical safety as part of that visit.
Now, for legal noticing purposes, since it's a chamber event on Thursday night, if more than two commissioners go to the event, we don't need to notice that as a public meeting, I don't think, or?
I don't know, but I can confirm that for you.
Okay.
I will be unable to attend, so.
So will I.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Commissioners.
Thank you.
Wanted to bring you up to date on some things that are going on in California. There's been a lot going on this summer, and we've chosen to become more actively involved in that. First of all, last week, state of California, the legislature did approve a extension for the cap and trade provision that the governor has signed. That's a significant issue for us because it does place a carbon price on all aspects of the California economy, including the electricity sector. And we do see, because California is such a big player in electricity markets, that when they place a price on carbon and it flows through to wholesale prices throughout the West. So there had been quite a debate that had gone on there. There was a period of time when it wasn't clear whether that bill was going to pass or not. And it has passed. And so ultimately that redounds to the benefit of our wholesale power sales. There has also been a piece of legislation that would expand the renewable portfolio standard from the current 50% RPS to a 60% and accelerates the date to achieve the 50% RPS. And there is also a goal that's established to create 100% renewable portfolio standard in some of the earlier versions of that bill. Some of the later versions have turned that into a goal of 100% zero emissions, but there are certain types of resources that would qualify, and large Northwest Hydro would not have qualified, at least under some versions of that bill. And that was a cause of significant concern to us and to many other players in the Northwest, including Bonneville and PowerX and others who sell power down there. We had been involved in putting together a study that looked at what the value was of doing new types of transactions with California. So this is not covering the existing transactions, but new types of transactions, primarily exchanges, because we see the large solar surplus that's developing down there. We think there's a lot of opportunity to do exchanges that would be daytime power flows north, which historically has not happened, but could happen in the future. And then it gets returned on the evening ramp or even at the nighttime hours. So we have completed a draft of that study, and we've been sharing it with our colleagues in the public generating community and at Bonneville. And they have been excited about that because it basically shows that there would be substantial dollar benefits as well as reduction in greenhouse gas emissions benefits, because you would stop using some of the combined cycle, the simple cycle combustion turbines in California to be able to deal with the ramp. So we had kind of had a draft of that by about early June or so, and beginning to express to friends in California their opportunity to expand trade between us, when at the same time this legislation was coming forward that would restrict trade between us. The way the study was done, there was an opportunity to be able to relatively low cost expand it to look at what would happen if there was a restriction on trade when Northwest Hydro was not able to be sold into the California market. Currently, about 5% of the California load is served by Northwest Hydro, and that results in about a 7% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and about $200 to $500 million of annual financial benefit to California. So we've taken our original study, expanded it to look at what would happen if there was a trade restriction. We have a draft of that, and we've begun sharing it, and we'll be doing more work on sharing this next week in California with folks down there. We have, through public generating pool, been engaging in the California legislature in our view on this. We had some success last week. The bill was amended. It appears to mostly take out the language that we found offensive. We still have some concerns about the way the language is drafted, but less than before. But we are still in the midst of the process. So our biggest concern is when you're in the midst of the process, you don't know what it's going to look like at the end. And so we intend to continue to be aggressive on this. I think this fits the board direction for us to find ways that we can not only advance our own interests, but work with others in the Northwest Hydro community to be able to find ways to be able to increase value for Northwest Hydro, working as a collaborative. We're working very closely with Bonneville and other public generating utility members on this and trying to get this message out. But we did take the lead in terms of putting the study together. So that's where things stand right now. We'll be keeping you informed as this evolves over the course of the next couple of months. Looks like the California legislature is out now on their summer recess, but we'd expect this probably to come to conclusion by early fall sometime.
So, Steve, because of the exchange, because of the ability to possibly sell some of their surplus solar, send that north, then they're more willing to accept our large hydro and possibly change the rules or
I think candidly we have really two different efforts here. Number one is we were going down this path of trying to encourage the regulatory agencies to change some of the rules in the market to allow more of these types of environmental exchanges. Mm. And what happened was when we were doing that work, it created an analytical foundation that we could use to evaluate this legislative proposal that would restrict trade. So we now are able to discuss the consequences of a trade restriction that we were able to put that together in just a couple of weeks. So now we're able to provide some information into the legislative discussion. Did that help?
Mm-hmm. It did. Yeah. Thanks.
Any other questions?
I just appreciate the effort by yourself and staff to dig in and work on that. I know that was a lot of work recently, and it just seems like that's got to have a big payoff for us. And I appreciate that. That work's coming.
Well, it seems like they're really up against it with this, you know, with this ramp issue that they're facing, and so they're going to have to open their eyes and ears and try to figure out, you know, a way to deal with that.
The alternative solutions are significantly more expensive, and the fundamental goal of greenhouse gas emissions reductions is not well served
mm-hmm.
by choosing a trade restriction path.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of us that were, and I think all of us may have seen the presentation that were put at the Energy Committee from Public Generating Pool, of the new duck diagram, the duck is getting much fatter.
I mean, belly's
the belly is sagging much further.
Further and quicker.
Yeah, mm-hmm. much faster. Mm-hmm. Yeah, way faster than anybody anticipated.
Right. Yeah.
For those that might be listening to this recording, the duck diagram shows the impact of solar on the imbalance of power available in California day and night.
Daily, yeah.
Okay, any other questions?
Just wanted to note that I will be out on August 4th for the next board meeting on vacation, and so there'll be somebody sitting in my chair here, and we're working on who that's going to be now. That's it, and I would just suggest if you're able to go to your commission actions, and I could even do after that the delegated action items as well, so we could possibly get those done before lunch.
Any commissioner items? I would I shared at the PUD Association, but not here locally. Last week I was back in Washington D.C. at policymakers, American Public Power policymakers, and our staff in conjunction with our lobby firm did a tremendous job of setting up appointments. We met with representatives of every member of the delegation, even though it was 95 degrees and 95% humidity. We had to make four trips across the hill. We managed to get under the hill on most of them. So staff people worked with us on going through the Capitol and not having to go out into the heat. But it was quite a delight to be able to go to our delegation, and pretty much universally, our delegation is really supportive of our issues, and I give a whole lot of credit to a lot of people other than us, like our staff, like Steve sitting here, for the work and our staff's been doing back there, educating on our issues on hydro relicensing, and the Columbia River Treaty, and the value of municipal bonds. It's been truly a team effort, but our delegation is really pretty much where they need to be, I think, in terms of right now for the issues that could potentially impact. So anyway, that's the only commission item I have. Back to follow-ups.
We had two from last meeting, one of which you've already seen. The first was to provide you some examples of the impacts of different rate actions, the financial impacts.
And so that was helpful. Thank you.
Package here today. The second one is all around the discussion of delegation of authority that Eric has. and he's working on those. Not sure whether we'll be bringing that back, which meeting in August, but anticipating that we'll be coming back in the August meeting and should address all of the issues that you have raised. That was it from the last meeting. And I just have one identified from this meeting, and that's the history of rate changes compared against inflation. All right. Miss anything?
I don't think so. Well, I think that's as far as we can go this morning.
I think that's right.
And so we will recess and reconvene at 1 o'clock, start an open session, immediately move to executive session.
And then we'll be coming out of executive session. Right.
At 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock for public session.
Okay. Good afternoon. This is Wednesday, July 24th, 2017. This is the Chelan Public Utility District Commission meeting. We met this morning in a study session. This afternoon, we have a business session, but today at 1 o'clock, we are starting by going into executive session for 1 hour till 2 o'clock to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs, and to review the performance of a public employee as authorized by the RCWs, and to consider the selection of a site or the acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause a likelihood of increased price as authorized by the RCWs. So we'll now move into executive session and reconvene in regular session at 2 o'clock. It is 2 minutes after 2. We've been in executive session for approximately an hour. We're coming back into regular session. And we will reconvene into regular session in about 2 minutes. Did I say no votes were taken, no decisions were made? Well, about 2 minutes, we'll come back in. Commissioners, I'd like to bring us back in order. And the next item on our agenda is the consent agenda. What's the wish of the commission with the consent agenda as it was revised this morning?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of the consent agenda as modified.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda as modified. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. I believe that we covered all other matters this morning, with the exception of additional public comment. I don't see any members of the general public here. Are there any other matters that necessarily may come before the commission?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move that we as a board offer to extend General Manager Steve Wright's employment contract for 3 years from September 3rd, 2018 to December 31st, 2021 on the following terms. No change to base salary or salary adjustment provisions of the contract. Add a retention clause providing for a 1% growing to 5% annual year-end retention payment for each year Steve remains with the district beginning at the end of 2017, and to continue to provide annual 401A contributions to be adjusted to equal to the difference between the permissible 401A employer match limit on Wright's 457 voluntary contribution and the permissible IRS limit, and direct the district general counsel to draft the appropriate documents.
I second the motion.
Motion has been made and seconded to extend Steve Wright's employment contract under the conditions that have been made in the motion. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried unanimously.
I just want to thank the commission. Enjoyed the employment and look forward to extended employment with the district.
Steve, on behalf of the commission, I'd like to say the pleasure is ours. We've
the last several years, you have shown us a method and an approach to management that is second to none, and we are absolutely excited to have your continued employment for the next several years. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I would just like to add, as a new commissioner, one of the first goals or mandates that were given to me by the public was to do everything in my power to continue your employment and provide stability and leadership at the PUD. I have to tell you, I was very surprised and pleased with those comments, the amount of comments that I had, and I'm really happy to say I've achieved my first goal from the public, the first mandate from the public that I was given, and it was very clear. So congratulations.
Yeah. Steve, I go back to the day we hired you and handed you that sheet of paper that had, I think, 14 things internally on one side and about the same amount on the other side that we wanted you as a commission to get after and get done, and huge progress, you know, on both sides of that sheet. But I think what underlines it most are the processes that you've brought and put in place that are drawing from our staff, I think, at a much, much deeper level, and an involvement in them representing the community in their work that is maybe the hallmark. So it's kind of a bigger picture, but it's processes that have really become significant, inclusive, and it is owned by the people, and you have respected that so well. Much appreciation.
Other comments? Any other business to come before the commission? If not, we'll stand adjourned.
Thank you.